So I am super excited and proud to have this guest on the podcast today. Today, we have Lauren Kane, who is the founder of VC Worthy Business. And let me tell you guys how I found Lauren. I was in a room on Clubhouse, and a lot of times I just lurk. I'm doing some investigations, listening to people, finding people that are true thought leaders that aren't just trying to get people to follow them or to sell them on something. And I had listened to Lauren speak in a few different rooms, and I thought, this woman knows what she's talking about, and she really gets it. What I loved about what Lauren had in her profile was she had a call to action that said, text me with any questions. So I remember being in a Clubhouse room with her, and I literally just texted her and told her, like, hey, I want to have you on the podcast. I think you'd be a great fit, and I love what you do. So what Lauren specializes in is she works with female founders to get investors to open up their checkbooks and support female founders, female entrepreneurs. So she's a pitch strategist. She helps female founders build their pitch and helps them understand what it's going to take to get funding. So if you are someone who has founded your own business and you don't want to bootstrap, maybe you actually want to get VC funding at some point or outsource your funding, this is an episode that you will absolutely love and really find a lot of value from. Lauren is so smart. She spent so much time in this industry. She used to work for other VC firms before starting VC Worthy, and she's brilliant. She knows what she's talking about, and she's clearly helped a lot of entrepreneurs. I learned so much listening to this episode, and I think she is just paving a path for more female founders and entrepreneurs to get funding, because I'm sure you guys have heard the stats, and we talk about the stats in this podcast episode, but it's not pretty. It's really actually, especially after 2020, it's pretty gruesome how women are just not getting their fair share of funding. So I love what Lauren's doing. She's really looking to turn that around. And I hope you guys learned something from today's episode, because it's a really good one. So I will catch you on the flip side. Hey, Lauren, welcome to the Next Big Thing podcast.
Hey, Sam. I'm so happy to be here.
You're the first, you're like a one of a kind, the first kind of person, I'll say that for right now, that we've had on this podcast. And the reason why I say that is because you're a pitch strategist. So I want to talk through this for a second. So first of all, that's like the coolest job title ever. I've never really talked to someone that says they're a pitch strategist, usually just a strategist. So it's very specific, and I can't wait to get into the details. So what does being a pitch strategist actually mean and entail?
Yeah. So what it entails, well, what it is basically I work with founders to hone their pitch when they're raising investor capital, to make sure that they are positioning themselves correctly to get the attention of the ideal investor for them. And then we also work on, okay, how are you going to get the attention of that ideal investor beyond just your pitch? So you got to get in the door first to then be able to pitch them. So it's really thinking through raising investor capital with the strategy lens, not just, hey, I want to raise, and so I'm going to go out and talk to any investor that I can.
Oh, that's interesting, because I'm sure that that's a lot of people when they first get started, which we'll talk about in a little bit. It's almost like they don't know where to start. There is no strategy behind who they talk to, how they talk to them, all that stuff. So that's a great point. And we'll get to some of those details in a little bit, but definitely stalk your LinkedIn. I'm very curious to know, because it looks like you were in operations for a little bit. What's your career path been like up until this point? And then how did you decide to pivot to being a pitch strategist?
Yeah. So I was in the corporate world. I started out in banking on the retail side. I was in banking for almost 10 years and left that and did a little bit of consulting for a bit in operations, and then took on a job that really changed my life. And that was becoming the director of operations for one of the country's largest angel groups, Golden Seeds. And I was there for 6 years. And it really was a whole new world that I'd sort of known about coming from the banking world. I'd heard the term venture capital. I sort of knew what angel investor was, but didn't have, you know, a real understanding. It was kind of something on the fringe. But basically walked into this whole world that had its own terminology, its own way of doing things, very fast paced and ever changing, and fell in love. And at Golden Seeds, I was thrown right into, they were raising their second fund. So they started raising when I joined. And so I helped them raise that second fund. We were, you know, from the time we were trying to get limited partners to sign on the dotted line, and then became their fund administrator of their three early stage venture capital funds. And, you know, just was like enthralled with that, and all limited partners and what that looked like and how that was structured. And then I was also the face of Golden Seeds once we invested in a portfolio company. So I like to say that founders would love to hear from me or hid from me, just depending on the day, what was going on in their company. I was either their favorite person or the person that they didn't want to hear from. But at Golden Seeds, it was the first time that I really saw the struggle that female founders go through. And it, you know, it's one of those things that it's not widely talked about, and especially was not widely talked about 11 years ago when I joined Golden Seeds. And, you know, in the corporate world, we know that the gap between men and women is, you know, a certain percent. But in the startup world, it's that times 10. It really is huge. And it is so not talked about. And I really saw so many founders, not female founders, not being supported and coming to fundraise sometimes too late. And it broke my heart. And so, you know, I was there in New York and did that for 6 years. And then left shortly after moving to Atlanta, which is where I am now, and wanted to go out and do my own thing. I think it's natural that you're in an entrepreneurial environment for so long that you kind of want to go out and do your own thing. And I became a business coach for female founders. And I joke that I became a business coach when the entire world became a business coach. And it's like everyone around me, I'm like, oh my gosh, you can trip over us. And
yeah,
was really struggling to find my footing. And you know, it was, I'm like, why isn't this working? Why isn't this a thing? And, it, you know, especially given my background, but was always being asked for, hey, could you connect me to an investor? Could you hear me pitch? Could I ask you a couple questions about what angel investing means? And always enjoyed doing that, and always love, you know, meeting a new founder. And so I finally had someone one day say to me, my business strategist. So I had a business strategist that I still work with. And she's like, why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you helping people with their pitches? You're doing it anyway. Why don't you turn it into a business? And so, you know, I did what any good entrepreneur did. I pivoted to what made sense. And when I did that, it was like, for me, everything opened up. I opened up, the world opened up for me. It was very natural progression because I was already doing it. And so it was such an easy shift, and I've never looked back. And then, you know, was able to, a couple years ago, Golden Seed started a chapter here in Atlanta and was able to become a member. And so I joke now that I've kind of sat on all sides of the table. And so it's really been an interesting ride that I'm really lucky to be able to be on.
I love it. And I like too that you're specialized, and it's really clear exactly what you do. It's almost like a blessing in disguise that you went down this path, because you're right, the business coach side is really saturated, but it's also very generic in the sense that if you just tell someone that you're a business coach, you really don't know what that means. But if you tell someone that you're a pitch strategist, especially in this space, people know right away exactly what that means. And I want to get to you too. You're a pitch strategist, and right now you're also an angel investor. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Nice. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. And when did you decide to become an angel investor as well?
You know, it's one of those things that, again, it was sort of a natural progression. I think being in this world, I don't know anyone in the venture capital world that doesn't, and even founders who have taken in capital, it's one of those things that's kind of always on your to-do list as I'm going to do that someday. And, you know, my husband had an opportunity to present itself, and it happened. And then Golden Seeds formed a chapter in Atlanta. And I'm like, okay, you know, this is meant to be. And so, you know, it is empowering to help female founders empower themselves. And so it, you know, selfishly, it is, you know, exciting, you know, for me, I think just as much as it's exciting for the founders. And I also know how much it means to them. And so it's, you know, it is one of those things that angel investing, you know, it is, it's one of those things where it's very risky. It's probably one of the most more risky investments that you can make because it's super early, right? And even early stage venture capital funds, it's super early. And so the chances of you getting your money back are, you know, a lot smaller than if I made a later stage investment. But I know that there is such a need there that, you know, it's kind of like, I can't help it. If I have the ability to do it, I need to do it.
Yeah, that's like, that's a dream of mine to become an angel investor at some point. That's like a career goal of mine. So you specialize in female founders specifically, which of course we love, everyone in the podcast, everyone listening loves that. But what are some stats that you've heard or experiences that you've had in this space that make focusing on female founders specifically so important to you?
Yeah. Okay. So I did pull some stats from last year, and you know, I knew them, but it was sort of, I had to like sit in them a little bit. So, you know, last year was a tough year. I think no one knew what was going to happen in March. So, you know, a year ago, no one knew what was going to happen if, you know, VCs were going to take their money and just hold it and not do anything. And I came into Golden Seeds right after the recession was over and people were starting to invest again and saw what happened. You know, the repercussions of people sort of holding onto their cash. And I was really scared that that was going to happen again, in 2020. And it didn't necessarily happen, but it happened a little bit more for women. So there was $150 billion invested in startups in 2020. 2.2% of that went to women. 2.2. Like that is, I mean, that just breaks my heart. And, you know, it's one of those things where I get upset and I want to cry. And I also am pissed off and want to hit someone. So it's a very mixed bag of emotion.
Same.
Yeah. But, you know, and I mean, and it just is a stat that has to change. And it started to change in 2019. It was higher in 2019. So it's about 0.3% less. But when you're talking in the billions, like that's a significant amount of money that was not going to women. Now, 90% of VCs are men. So I think that, you know, that's one of the reasons that the number is just as dismal as it is. I don't know if there were less women seeking capital, but, you know, there's on Crunchbase, there's this unicorn list. And there were 120 companies on it for last year, and only 10 were women, as opposed to last year, which was 20.
Are you serious?
Yeah. And so I think that there might have been less women seeking capital. I think part of the issue with last year is that there were so many people home that what happened was people were thinking, oh, that business that I wanted to start, that I've been, you know, toying with, tinkering with, I'm just going to do it. And I think I need money. And going out and fundraising, where they might not have been ready or been something that was even investor worthy or something that was just not really something an investor would invest in. And it really has crowded the pipeline for a lot of funds, a lot of investors. They're seeing a lot of deal flow, but it's not necessarily quality deal flow. And so they are wading through all of these applications and these pitches to get to the ones that are really worth it. And so it is a struggle to get your, especially if you're doing it on paper, right? It is really a struggle if you're in an application and you have to just fill out the application or just send in your pitch deck. It is hard to make a case basically in writing of why you're the person to pitch for them and why they should invest in you. It is really, really hard to do that. And so, you know, I think there were great companies out there that were just not, you know, making their way to the top of the stack. So I think that's part of the reason that the number is so low. I think women also struggle with when to ask for money. It's a thing, myself included, totally myself included. And so we were already in a year of craziness. And I think people were like, well, should I go out and do this thing? I don't know if I should go do this thing. And so, you know, I think, you know, I saw a lot of women that I think doubted themselves, that it was time or wanted to put in the work. And you know, it just, I hope that it will change. I really do. And you know, I think that it will, you know, I have to hope that it will, and know that it will, because there are so many women-owned, women-led companies out there that really deserve to be funded, and investors are losing out. They really are.
Yeah. So this is a great segue. I want to hear your thoughts on, and I know you could probably talk about this forever, but if we were to just talk about like the key pieces of criteria that make a startup fundable in the first place, like what would you say if you were to like chunk it out into like three things, what would that be?
I think the first one, which is a major one that I don't think founders think of right out of the gate, at least, is are you going to be able to let go of your company at some point? So it has
to. Ooh, that's a tough one. Yeah. From the get-go, that's a tough one.
Yeah. I mean, think about it. Like, it's your baby, and you nurture it and watch it grow, and you know, all the things that you do to you know, get the revenue in the door and make it scalable and bring on a team, and to want to walk away from that is a hard thought to have. But investors, the way that they're going to make their money is that there is an exit event. So whatever that exit event looks like, whether it is IPO, which would be amazing, IPO going public, or you know, there's an acquisition, or there is private equity that comes in. So that there's an exit event where everyone makes money. That's what investors are looking for. And typically the founder, if they're still the CEO at that point, they will have to eventually phase out of their company and let go. And so if that's something that a founder doesn't want to do, then, and that's okay, right? That's totally okay. If you see yourself running your company for the rest of your life, do it, go for it. But you might need to think through, is fundraising right for you? The other thing is it scalable? And is it scalable to where it's going to, again, make that, you know, pot of money at the end of the rainbow kind of thing. Can you tell we're getting, you know, I'm thinking about St. Patrick's Day. You know, that there is really, you know, you can scale your company to be, you know, the revenue be in, you know, hundreds of millions. You know, what does it look like? And you have to be able to look that far ahead to see that it's possible. If it's not, then it's going to be really hard to raise investor capital, because they're not going to be able to get, if you can't get on board with that, if it doesn't seem like you can get the numbers there, they're not going to want to talk to you, because there has to be enough there that they're going to have a, you know, when that exit comes, that there's an, you know, enough money. It is money driven. This is an investment. Investors put money into a company to get their money back with, you know, a 20 times return is what they're seeking in the beginning stages. So, you know, that has to be something that's possible. The other thing is, you know, your company has to be disruptive. And I like to say it can either be big D disruptive or little D disruptive. And, you know, to sort of define what that means is it changes the way people do something or use something or live their life. And it can be in the littlest ways to the biggest ways. So like, you know, Facebook, that is big D disruptive. That has completely changed how we, you know, consume social media. Clubhouse is big D disruptive, completely changed the face of social media and how we know it. But, you know, if you have a, like Spanx to me is at the beginning was a little D disruptive, changing the way that women wear shapewear and look at shapewear. That's a little D disruptive. Now, I think it, you know, now is big D disruptive, but it really, at the beginning stages, was not in the grand scheme that big of a thing. You know,
yeah, really. It's like you would have never looked at that and been like, holy shit, that's going to be a like multi-billion-dollar company.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm sure probably a lot of people laughed at her and said, there's no way you're ever going to make, you know, enough money that this business is going to go anywhere. But you know, she changed, she had a vision. She had a vision that it was going to scale and, you know, grow into something. And I'm sure it's beyond what Spanx ever thought that it could be. And you know, now it is a $1 billion company. I mean, you know, it doesn't get much better than that.
So question for you on that, how much is attitude and the founder's outlook and attitude a player in this versus the actual business idea or company? Because obviously, and you've heard pitches on Clubhouse, because for those listening, Lauren is in a lot of these rooms talking to founders one-on-one. But A lot of times, a lot of founders have imposter syndrome or don't have the conviction in their ideas, even if their ideas are actually really great. So what would you say for founders who are seeking funding, who maybe do have a great idea, but don't see that outlook because they're trying to be modest or they have imposter syndrome? Or does it matter if maybe an idea isn't as disruptive, but the founder is just has this like conviction and confidence that carries it through?
Yeah. I mean, if you are a founder that has conviction and confidence, you have to make sure that comes through in your pitch. You have to make sure an investor sees that because that is part of the package. In the beginning, it is the founder just as much as it is the business. And I have seen investors that will back a amazing founder that they know will, you know, go on to do big things, even if it's not the business that they're currently in. They will back them because they know if they back them now, when they go do their big thing, they're going to remember who backed them the first time out of the gate. So, you know, it really is about you showing that you can do this, that there's nothing that's going to get in your way to doing this. And, you know, not everyone has the chops or the personality for it. I'll be real. It takes a special person to go from founder to being CEO, because that's really what happens once they take in money. They are building their company and growing it out, and they are stepping into being a CEO. And that is not a role for everyone. It is also okay to fundraise and say, I'm not the person to do this. I want to bring on someone to take on that CEO role. I'm going to do the part that I'm really good at in the company that I love doing, or I'm going to stay on as just a founder. That's completely okay.
Quick question. Can you, for those listening, can you just make a clear distinction between like how you differentiate between a founder and a CEO?
Yeah. So I, you know, and there are times where they're completely the same, but sort of from a mental perspective, founder is that, you know, person like, okay, I had this idea, I'm building out the thing, you know, maybe you've got a, you know, MVP going and you're like, okay, I'm going to do this. And then you take in, you know, $2 million. And now it is changing gears of doing all the things, right? The founder wears all the hats to being a CEO. Now you need to bring on key hires. You need to model what the right behavior is. You need to build a culture and an environment of a thriving company. And that is a CEO. The CEO takes the vision and mission of a company and brings it to life and leads. And so that to me is really the difference. And it's a mental shift because you have to let go of the things, all the things that you were doing. You have to trust in the people that you've brought on that probably know a lot of those things better than you do. But you know, it can be hard to say, oh, you're going to do marketing. Okay. But okay. You sure you don't want to do it this way, my way.
Right.
Even though you have much more experience than I do.
Yeah, exactly. Cause you've just been in it for so long, right? That it's hard to see outside of it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And it's hard to, you know, trust that someone is going to believe in your business just as much as you do. It's a really hard thing, but it can happen and it's possible. It's doable. But you know, in terms of mindset, I say this a lot, and I hope that this resonates with the founders listening. When you're pitching, the thing to think about, if you're like, I can't get into the space of like feeling like I'm empowered, because a lot of times there can be a mental shift to desperation when you're looking for money, right? That you'll do whatever investors want because they hold the purse strings, and you need that money. But I want the founders to think about that really they have the power and they need to shift that. If they don't feel like they have it, they need to really envision that shift happening, because there are thousands of investors out there, thousands, maybe a million, I don't know, out in the world. There is one company doing what they're doing, one company. There might be others doing similar things, but there is one company with her as a founder, and no one else is going to build that same team and do it in the way that she's going to do it. And so she has the power, you know, to make herself and those investors some serious dough. So really the female founders have all of the power in the relationship and they don't need to give up any of it.
Ooh, yes. I love it. Also, I love what you said too, because obviously someone in marketing, it's so much of like how you position yourself and what your branding looks like and all of these packaged parts that really do differentiate you from other brands, like you said, that might be doing the same things out there. So you talked about earlier, I want to get into this and get your thoughts on this, because you talked about sometimes there are startups that get into funding too late. So what are some like telltale signs that a startup should start to consider funding to where they're not going to be too late in the game? And like, what does it mean to be too late?
Yeah. I mean, I think to answer the second part first, to be too late is you have 2 months of runway left and then you're going to have to close your doors. That's it. You're not going to raise that quickly. It's going to be very hard to get, you know, through due diligence in that short amount of time. And so, you know, you don't want to be in that position. But you know, the time to think through whether you should fundraise is, you know, well, you can't bootstrap anymore. If you're just like, okay, there's, I got nothing left. I'm at a wall. I've put in everything that I can put in. And we're really at a turning point that if we had an influx of capital, it could change the game and the course of the business. If you have revenue and you're at a point where, you know, if you just got it over this certain point that you would be good. And you knew if that point was spending, you know, X amount of dollars on marketing or having these key hires that you brought on to help you expand the business. Those are times to bring on investors. And it can also be when you're like, okay, I need to have these certain doors open for me that I can't get through. I really need someone with connections. That can also be investors. So if you're, you know, it doesn't have to be, if that's all you need, then maybe you need an advisory board and not necessarily investors, but it can be a mix of, I need money and I need doors open. And so then you look for investors that are going to write you checks. And then also if they have connections, they're going to give you access to those connections and really help, you know, ease up some of the burden that you have.
Love it. And let's talk about quickly friends and family. So you hear that all the time. People go through raising friends and family. When is it appropriate to raise friends and family, and who's the right fit for that?
Yeah, friends and family, I would say if you're raising under, you know, anywhere from 250,000 to 500, if you're raising under that, really, I would go to your friends and family, or as I like to say, your friends of friends, possibly. And, or if you've built up enough of a customer base that are really loyal and love you, that you go out and maybe do some crowdfunding to those customers, do some equity crowdfunding and have them be part of your raise. But if you're raising a small amount, that's not necessarily going to be something that investors are going to look at, or, you know, institutional investors are going to look at. You could maybe get an angel or two for a smaller amount. Like if you're doing 100K, I would say it's probably going to be a mix of friends and family and maybe an angel investor in there. It's more of a back of a napkin kind of raise than a formalized process where, right, you're having, you know, all these deal terms negotiated. It really is, okay, this is just is what it is. Are you going to help me out and going to be on board or not? Are you there for this ride or are you not? Kind of thing. So, you know, and sometimes friends and family is all founder needs to sort of get them over the hump, and then they don't need to raise anymore or want to raise anymore. And you can even look at friends and family as a loan, so that it's something you pay back. So it's not even taking an equity. It really could be, okay, I'm going to pay this back to you in 2 years or a year or whatever it might look like. So friends and family sort of gives you more flexibility early on. When you go formalized, I like to say when you're raising investor capital, be prepared to continue to fundraise after that that initial raise. And so you're going to be raising subsequent rounds because you need to grow at a certain rate. When you're doing friends and family, they're not caring necessarily how fast you're scaling. So it's your comfort level, really.
Right. When you're working with startups through this pitch process, have you ever encountered people who maybe are looking to bring investors in, and how do you matchmake? I don't even know really what the right term is, but is there like a component of matchmaking where just because an investor is going to give money, that doesn't necessarily mean that that's the right fit for the startup either, if that makes sense?
Yeah, no, totally. You know, I have seen, and I hate saying this, but if you bring in an investor who I like to say is, you know, well, an a-hole during due diligence, they're probably going to be even more so once you have their money. And I've seen those types of investors that kill companies. They can just bring them to their knees. And it's not because they want to. It's not like they're trying to lose money. It's that it just wasn't a right fit. And, you know, it goes back to that being desperate part. The founder just needed the money and the investor, you know, wanted to invest. They didn't see themselves probably as difficult, but you know, it can be extremely detrimental if you don't have, if you take in the wrong money, it really can. I think, you know, the number one thing to keep in mind when you are fundraising is, and, you know, I do a bit of matchmaking. It's for sure matchmaking. But really, you know, my job is the introduction and letting the founder do the rest because they need to date that investor. It is not about, hey, let me pitch to you right out of the gate. It's let me get to know you as a person, especially early on. They need to get to know them and find out, okay, what type of companies do you typically invest in? You know, how active are you? What are your expectations? Do you like to be involved or do you want to just write a check and not hear from, you know, hear from me until I send you out our quarterly update? What does it look like? You know, maybe you interview some of the companies that they've invested in previously to see what their experience was. So you really have to make sure it's a fit. A fund is a little bit more tricky than, you know, an angel. An angel, you can do that. The general partner to the fund, you know, you want to make sure that you're talking to the right people of who's going to be involved. Who are you reporting to? You know, who's going to be the person to support you? And do they like to open doors for their founders? Really, your investors should want to help and support you any way that they can. If they have access to something, it should, you know, you should have access to it too. And so you really want to make sure it is the right fit. And it is okay to say no to an investor. And it could be just that you're not a right fit. Like, trust your gut. Women, we have extraordinary gut intuition. We have to learn to listen to that when it comes to seeking investor capital, because it goes a long way. And that can mean the difference between, you know, you having a pleasant experience with your investors versus you feeling like dealing with your investors is another full-time job.
Yeah, right. And it's also, I bet too, I bet it's a process that feels better too for the investor to know that this person isn't just so desperate for money, but they actually care about vetting the other side too.
Yeah. I mean, it shows them that they're really grown up and that they're thinking through this. And, you know, sometimes, you know, playing a little hard to get as a founder can work, build up that sense of maybe FOMO with an investor, but it shows them that they aren't just going to take in any money, that they're really thinking through the strategy of the company and how it's going to grow and who they are as a founder first.
Mm-hmm. So there are probably a lot of entrepreneurs listening who can't even imagine having these conversations that we're talking about right now. Maybe they have an idea that is actually a wonderful idea. The execution's there and they are actually going to scale, but in their minds, they don't think that they're investable or that it's kind of like a daunting process. Like, what do you do in particular to help female entrepreneurs kind of like take the weight off initially and just chill out?
Yeah. You know, the first thing really is to get them to feel like it's not such a daunting task. It shouldn't be another full-time job. It really should be something that you plan out to a place where you have a set number of hours that you're working on it a week. And so that's really what we start off the first thing doing is like, okay, what is doable? And how are you not going to get to a point where you're exhausted? Because so many founders fundraise, spend so much time fundraising, and then they get the money in the bank and they have nothing left and it's go time. They're expected to then, you know, hit play on all the things that they said they were going to do with that money, and they have nothing left to give. And that's not where anyone wants to be. And your investors don't want you to be in that place too. So we really work on what is the strategy and plan that makes the most sense for that founder, what's doable. And, you know, it depends on their personality type. It depends on what they have going on. So it's a lot of different variables. And it's also how they feel about their pitch. You know, if they're not loving the pitch that they're going out and giving, then it doesn't seem very fun. But if they really love talking about their business and their pitch is something that they shine through and the company shines through, they're so much more apt to want to go out and do it, right? It makes it fun. And so I like to say I put the fun back in fundraising, which I know it's a little cheesy, but
no, I love it.
I try to.
People are just like, nor you just put fun into fundraising. So I don't think anyone, I think most people are like, this is exhausting. Yeah. So I think that's great.
And it shouldn't be. And we talk about, okay, how can we, you know, get this to a place where when you go to do those next raises, because you will, that it's really an easy thing to do and they don't need me again.
That's powerful. That's awesome. I love that. You looked up the stats before. We know the stats. The odds are definitely stacked against female founders and even more so for minority founders. What are some honest, and I want to get like real here, what are just some honest truths that women need to go into or need to have in mind when they're going into a pitching scenario?
Yeah. So it's going to be mostly white men that you're talking to. And it depends on what your business is. They might not get it. And it is your job.
They might not get it because they're white men.
Because they're white men. Yeah. And you know, one of the things that I'm thrilled about, but I hope investors get on this, is the femtech industry right now is a $3 billion industry. By 2027, it's expected to be a $60 billion industry.
Wow.
That's huge.
Huge.
But someone in femtech has a really hard time to get a male VC investor, angel, whomever, to see the value in it because they're not living it. And so the reason that mostly white men receive funding is because the investors can relate to them. And so the brutal honesty is you have to get those male investors to relate to you as a woman. It can be hard. I have, you know, worked with some very female centric companies, you know, and to as their customers, as their product, it's very female centric. And we have to be really, you sort of, you know, play some Jedi mind tricks in their pitch to get male investors to see the value.
Yeah, right.
Especially if it's a topic that make men uncomfortable.
Like if you were like doing what? Like, can you give me an example like of like maybe something you worked on? Yeah, totally. I was just going to say that. Right.
Or women's reproductive, you know, women's reproductive system in any way, shape or form, you know, not even an investor room, just historically makes men, you know, sort of twitch. So, you know, that is a hard barrier to break through. It shouldn't be, right? It shouldn't be the case, but it is. You can make it not necessarily relatable, but you can make it fun and you can make an investor feel connected to you enough that they, at the beginning, that they want to listen to what you have to say all the way through. And that's where if you shine through and you come through as a powerful founder, that they then want to, you know, continue the conversation. They might not know why, but they do. And so, you know, that is really the hard thing is to get them to want to continue the conversation. You know, the hard facts are if you have a male co-founder, they're going to want the male co-founder there. Because again, they're going to feel connected more to him.
Doesn't it say like the stats too are like actually better if you have a male co-founder, which is crazy.
I think last year, one of the stats I looked at, if I think it was 25 out of $25 million raised that, they looked at only 5 million was from female founders only. The other 20 was male and female co-founder team. So that I'm like, oh gosh, that's frustrating.
My God.
But it's, you know, it is what it is. And the only way I will say this, the only way that we're going to change it is that women continue to ask for fundraising, you know, or continue to ask for investor capital. They don't let the statistics bring them down. They then grow their companies to do amazing things, have a exit, make a crap ton of money, and turn around and invest in other female-led businesses. So they, in turn, become investors in those coming behind them. And that is really the only way it's going to happen on a grander scale. And it takes time. It's not a quick fix, but it's doable. And it shouldn't be that 90% of investors are men. You know, it should be that it is 50-50. It should be that we have, you know, enough room at the table for everyone. There should be, you know, not just gender diversity. There should be, you know, there should be every person, kind of person on the planet should be represented in a, you know, meaningful percentage of the number of investors in the world.
Hell yes. I agree so much. What do you think is the future of female funding? And like, where do you think this space is headed?
Yeah. I mean, at least for this year, I think that equity crowdfunding is going to become big. I think we're going to see a lot more people go that direction because they're getting frustrated by, you know, investors not getting back to them and them being investors being overwhelmed by deal flow that, you know, and them not knowing that, but, you know, being overwhelmed by deal flow and not getting back to them. I mean, investors are not the best at responding. I'm just going to be real. They're
you know what? That's good. Set expectations. That's a great expectation to set. Like, don't get butthurt if someone doesn't get back to you.
Yeah. It's not personal. It's not personal at all. They just are overwhelmed or they just don't respond to anything they don't feel connected to. And they're human, right? They're completely human. Right. But I think equity crowdfunding, especially with, you know, the change in the amount that you can raise, I think that that's really going to be a big thing in 2021. And, you know, I think that women are pissed off that they don't have access to capital as much as men do. And I'm hoping that that means that we're really not just talking about seeing changes, but that there will actually be changes to it. I mean, you know, I've been in this world for over 10 years, and this has been a very slow build. And I hope that now we're at sort of a precipice and it explodes. I hope that, you know, gender diversity, investing in female founders is now a thing and not just something investors talk about.
Yes. What do you see as the future of your role in all of this? And like, you're a pitch strategist now, are you planning on evolving that? Or do you, would you like to stay as a pitch strategist?
I think I'm always going to be a pitch strategist. I'll be honest. I have so much fun with it. Meeting different companies and founders, like there's nothing better. Seeing how women are going to change the world and like even being the tiniest part of that is kind of awesome. Not going to lie.
Totally.
I see where I would like to eventually take my business is to find a way to educate female founders sooner rather than later. And I'm still trying to figure out what this looks like, but I want women to know and feel empowered to explore investor capital as an option. It might not be an option for them, and that's okay. But just knowing that there are options, there is power in that. And so really, you know, promoting that and having women feel like, okay, I have a place where I can be educated on what this world looks like. And I have an easier time, you know, of being successful at it. And, you know, at some point, I really would love to spend more time with young girls and letting them know that entrepreneurship is something that they could put on their radar if they want to eventually.
Yes. Oh my God. Totally.
You know, when you get there, what do you do? You know? And so, but I hope that there will, you know, I mean, I would love that there is a day that I'm not needed anymore. I would love that. You know, nothing would bring me, it's so weird to say this. greater joy to say, oh my gosh, there's not a need for me anymore. I need to figure out something else to do. Right. Or maybe I just am a full-time investor. I don't know. But like that would mean that we have like grown leaps and bounds. And I would happily, you know, hang things up for that for sure.
Oh my gosh. I would totally agree with you because everything we just talked about, if we can get to a place where that's not needed, that's amazing. And I am so in agreement with getting this next generation thinking about and feeling empowered to become an entrepreneur, to create a startup, to create the next big thing, because we need more of that encouragement too, as opposed to just looking at the stats and being like, you know what? This is really shitty. Like we need someone to lift people up. So I am totally in agreement with that. This has been phenomenal. I can't wait for this episode to go live. Where can people find you if they want to chat with you?
Yeah. So my website is vcworthybusiness.com. They can also check me out on Clubhouse as Lauren Kane, Instagram as Lauren Kane VCWB. And my website is the perfect place to go. And if you are looking to just talk about fundraising, dipping a toe in the water, I offer a free pitch strategy session and a link is on my website to it where we can just chat.
Oh my God, you're amazing. Okay, thank you so much for this. This was just, I'm just so excited for people to listen to this and feel more empowered with what they learned. So thank you so much for your time. I hope that episode inspired you just as much as it inspired me. Listen, I have not thought about selling my marketing business or even getting outside funding at any point. However, after listening to Lauren, I feel like there's actually a chance that if I wanted to do that for myself, I could do it. And the same goes for you listeners. If you really felt like, you know, I hope you felt like Lauren can help you through the process and it's not as scary and daunting as people make it out to be. And I just love what she's doing for women. She's really empowering this space and helping move us forward. So thank you, Lauren, for coming in the podcast. You are a true leader, and I can't wait to see where you take female entrepreneurs and how you help them, because you're doing something that's so important for all of us. If you guys love today's episode and you've just found so much value from it, please consider taking a second, swiping up if you're on your iPhone, and just leaving us a rating and review. It goes a super long way and it means the world to me. And whenever I see a new review, I am so giddy and excited. You guys, like, it's a joke. I get so pumped. So thank you for your support. And I hope we can continue to grow this podcast together and get it in front of more people who really need to hear episodes like the one today. So thanks again for listening, and I will see you guys next week.